Hey, I'd like to pray again as we start this class, specifically for this class. Let's pray. Lord, we want to learn about you today, not about us. Help us to always seek your kingdom and your righteousness for your name's sake. I pray that we'll have our eyes open and our hearts attuned to see what you've wrought in history, and to separate what you've wrought from any corruption we or others like us might have added. Lord, make us curious. Make us honest questioners. Give us humility to see and to apply, to reflect and to proclaim your truth before all men. In the name of the risen Christ. Amen. If you saw your email, the title of this class is essentially boiled down, The Key to the Revolution. And, of course, the title of the overall class is The Christian Revolution, A History of Christ's Transformation of Humanity. And the purpose of the class is to educate us, or maybe remind us, about the many positive ways that Christianity and Christians have changed the world. In the largest sense, I think that it's a study of what used to be called, was commonly called, Christendom. And that is the word that was used to describe the lands that had been most affected by Christianity, or the lands where Christianity held sway. That was the common term. Those lands since the Enlightenment have been renamed the West or Western civilization. And most of us in high school probably had a Western Civ class, and we may have been ready to hang ourselves after, you know, three or four sessions. I always think of the woman in Airplane on the seat next to the main protagonist after he's told his story, and you see her feet dangling a few minutes later. But let me just read you something. I want to read you a summary by one historian on the value and accomplishments of Western civilization. Hang with me for a minute. This is a fairly lengthy quote, but I think it's worth our attention. This is a historian writing. My attitude toward Western civilization is an attitude based on obvious facts and great accomplishments. Here is a reality full of wonderful and amazing things. Recognizing this doesn't mean that I'm blindly fascinated. This is the very opposite of the attitude of those who deny and ignore the bright lights of Western civilization. Just look around you, and you'll notice that everything beautiful in our life has been produced by Western civilization. Even the pen that you're holding in your hand, the recording instrument in front of you, the light in the room, and the journal that you may be reading from, and the many innumerable amenities, which are like miracles for ancient civilizations. If it were not for the accomplishments of the West, our lives would have been barren. I only look objectively and value justly what I see and express it honestly. Whoever does not admire great beauty is a person who lacks sensitivity, taste, and observation. Western civilization has reached the summit of science and technology. It has achieved knowledge, skills, and new discoveries as no previous civilization before it. The accomplishments of Western civilization cover all areas of life, methods of organization, politics, ethics, economics, and human rights. It is our obligation to acknowledge its amazing excellence. Indeed, this is a civilization that deserves admiration. The horrible backwardness in which some nations live is the inevitable result of their refusal to accept this abundance of Western ideas and visions while taking refuge in denial and arrogance. My admiration for the West is not at the expense of others. Rather, it's an invitation to those others to acknowledge their illusions and go beyond their inferiority and liberate themselves from backwardness. Those others should admit their shortcomings and make an effort to overcome them. They should stop denying the truth and closing their eyes to the multitude of wonderful achievements. They should be fair toward those nations that have achieved prosperity for themselves but did not monopolize it for themselves, and instead allowed the whole world to share the results of this progress so that other nations of the whole world now enjoy those achievements. Furthermore, Western civilization has given the world knowledge and skills which made it possible for them, the non-Western nations, to compete with it in production and to share markets with it. There is no one reason. There are 1,000 reasons, which all induce me to admire the West and emphasize its absolute excellence in all matters of life. Western civilization is the only civilization that liberated man from his illusions and shackles. It recognized his individuality and provided him with capabilities and opportunities to cultivate himself and realize his aspirations. Western civilization humanized political authority and established mechanisms to guarantee relative equality and relative justice, and to prevent injustice and to alleviate aggression. This does not mean that it is a flawless civilization. Indeed, it is full of deficiencies. Yet it is the greatest which man has achieved throughout history. Before the advent of Western civilization, humanity was in shackles of tyranny, impotence, poverty, injustice, disease, and wretchedness. How does that statement strike you? Does it make you cringe at all, a little bit? Make you cringe a little bit. You kind of wince at it. You know, it's kind of like an exercise in cheerleading, in a sense. God was not mentioned. That's exactly right. Arrogantly bold. Probably the term I would use to describe it. And, you know, smug self-satisfaction like that might make us leery of a study like the one we're in, which in its essence is what's right about Christianity, how Christianity's made the world a better place. And most of us, on the other hand, are pretty well versed, or at least we think we are, in the failings of Christianity. We know about bad popes. We know about bad bishops. We know about crusades and inquisitions, about unholy alliances of church and state, about 100 years' wars and suppression of science. And we may, in fact, as many people do, see the influence of Christianity as at least as bad as it has been good, or at least embarrassingly inconsistent. There are many who think they know exactly what the West has achieved and exactly where it got its advantage, that the West enslaved and stole from the rest of the world. That's subtext of movies that I've watched over the last 20 years. An awful lot of them. And an awful lot of them had worthwhile things to say, pointed out significant failings of people from Christian nations and even potentially folks proclaiming to know the name of Christ. But there are other eminent academics who note that the record of Christianity is far more good than bad, even in the face of weak-willed or even pathetically impotent Christians. We should honestly engage with a historical record. And we have to, frankly, honestly engage with statements like this from this historian. Lance mentioned David Bentley Hart, from whose book the title of this class was drawn. He claims that Christianity made a revolutionary impact on humanity that manifested itself in historically stupendous advances. Professor Kenneth Grasso seconds it. He says, and I quote, "The rise of Christianity precipitated a revolution in human self-understanding." And then Rodney Stark, who you'll hear that name a lot, Rodney Stark, who's a social historian and a self-proclaimed agnostic, says, "Christian theology is the catalyst, not the brake, for progress in Western history." Now, before we go any further, you might want to know that that statement that I read from that historian was written by the reformist Saudi Islamic historian Ibrahim al-Bulehi. You might also want to know that the context of his statement was the admiration for that critical component that he believes made Western civilization great, in both its physical and its cultural accomplishments. What he believes is the linchpin to Western progress. Its intrinsic attitude toward itself. That is, how have Westerners thought about themselves historically? He makes the point that the way that Westerners have thought about themselves is the key to Western progress. He calls it an attitude of self-examination and self-criticism. The secular Arab scholar, Ibn Warraq, who, by the way, that's a pen name he has to write under for fear of reprisal from Islamic true believers, writes in his book, Defending the West, that the unique cultural component of the West is self-criticism. He claims, as do many other scholars, that it has never been found historically in a culture previous to it. Let me repeat that. This is an atheist Arab scholar who is agreeing with an Islamic Arab scholar that Western civilization, or what used to be called Christendom, is a society whose achievements and accomplishments and progress were based upon an attitude that does not present itself culturally ever before. Self-criticism. So in one sense, we go from this cheerleading statement written by somebody who's not a Christian, who's observing, and he's not mentioning God. Because, by the way, he, and we'll go into this in a minute, he and Warraq both locate this self-criticism in the Enlightenment. And so, in a philosophy that was anti-God to a large degree. We'll talk about that a little bit more. There were multiple Enlightenments, but by and large, the Enlightenment was, in its essence, was a desire to free men from shackles that they had been under, one of the chief of which was religion. All religions, including Christianity. Well, and it's probably worth talking about that. Both Bulehi and Warraq, as I say, locate self-criticism in the Greek philosophers. And certainly if you've read Plato and Plato's dialogues of Socrates, if you've read Aristotle, you are seeing men who we're grappling with big questions. Who am I? What is the nature of the good? How do I become good? How can a society be good? Now, as you read those philosophers, you're going to see a lot of things that, with our Western sensibilities, are very glaring kinds of off-putting attitudes. For example, a very blithe acceptance of slavery, as an example. Aristotle specifically said there are people who are slaves by nature. And then there are those who are meant to rule over them. Well, that bugs us. Question is, why does that bug us? That's where I think Belahi and Warwick are onto something. These things bug us. We have developed in our culture, even though we haven't met the standard in all ways and at all times, we have certain common things that are fingernails on a blackboard. Triumphalist statements are one of those. For a lot of us, they may not be for everybody. I mean, we are in the, you know, we're in the land of competition and we are in the land of sports and we're in the land of my team is great and your team stinks and this and that and the other. And so there can be an element of that, certainly, that finds its way into the way we view different cultures. When I took geography, and more recently when I have substitute taught, I substitute taught a geography class twice, I think it was, at Brentwood Academy. And the basic way that you teach geography is really not much of a comparison of cultures. It really doesn't come into that. It's a description of culture. It's a accounting for what are the physical attributes or deficits of a society. What is the pluralism in those societies? In other words, how many different kinds of cultures are in that society? Or is it a monocultural society, just one dominant culture? And then it's essentially the message is, let's appreciate all cultures. Let's view the wonderful, crazy quilt of this world and appreciate the fact that there's so much diversity. If anybody's been around a geography class, and I'm saying that wrong, you let me know. But I was struck with how much more insistent that was in the textbook that I was substitute teaching from than it was when I was growing up in the 60s. I think that message has probably gotten stronger as time has gone by. But the Enlightenment, if that's where this resides, if Greek philosophy is where this resides, then we're dealing with something entirely different. Because the view that originated with the Enlightenment thinkers were the views of people like Thomas Hobbes or Spinoza, the Italian. And there's a whole body of literature in the Enlightenment called the Critiques of Religion. In fact, Voltaire, who was really one of the leading lights of the Enlightenment, defined religion as the enemy of man. And again, the idea was that Enlightenment would free us from those shackles, would free us for the need for religion by turning to reason. In fact, Jean Meslier, who was another one of the French philosophes, as they're called, said, "I would like the last of the kings to be strangled by the guts of the last priest." Now, what's interesting, though, is Christianity has been a greatly adaptive culture. And no one appreciated the Greek philosophers more, for example, than St. Thomas Aquinas. Aquinas appropriated Aristotle. Some people say Christianized Aristotle. But what I believe he was doing was recognizing in Aristotle and his thought something that Paul writes about in Romans chapter 1. He saw the reasoning of these Greek philosophers as a type of divine inspiration. Here's a quote. Aquinas was sympathetic towards and influenced by Aristotle, to whom he customarily refers as the philosopher. In a similar vein to Aristotle, Aquinas formulates a theory of ethics known as natural law. Aquinas assumes that God created the world, that the world reveals His purpose in creating it, and that the fulfillment of that purpose is the supreme good to be sought. Natural law, this is his direct quote, is the participation of the human person in the divine law of God. Elsewhere, he declares that the natural law is nothing other than the light of understanding infused in us by God, whereby we see what is to be done and what is not to be done. That sounds like Romans 1. We are not too far removed from a deep look at Romans 1. Does that resonate? So the source of self-criticism, whether for the Greek philosophers or for Christians, is, or for anyone else, frankly, is recognition of an unmet standard. The need to replace the is with the ought. Let's read Romans 1 again, just real quick. Romans 1, 18 through 20, and then he echoes this in chapter 2, 14, 15. For God's wrath is revealed from heaven against all godlessness and unrighteousness of people who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth, since what can plainly be known about God is evident among them, because God has shown it to them. From the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, that is, His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through what He has made. As a result, people are without excuse. And the quote from chapter 2 I'm going to read to you out of the Message. When outsiders who have never heard of God's law follow it more or less by instinct, they confirm its truth by their obedience. They show that God's law is not something alien, imposed with us from without, but woven into the very fabric of our creation. There's something deep within them that echoes God's yes and no, right and wrong. In effect, what that says is the basic standard of right and wrong is a common grace, which is not a term that is in a lot of common currency here, but is very, very deep in Christian theology. The idea of common grace that's given to all men. Without a true motive, men are able to experience and they're expected to do the works of God's law after a fashion. Now, the full biblical law extends that grace. It deepens it, enriches it. But everybody's got this basic understanding. But the claim of the Enlightenment was that's the source of Western progress really flies in the face of the evidence. Carl Becker, eminent historian. Anybody that's got a history degree will have read Carl Becker's work on the Declaration of Independence, among many other things. Carl Becker is a progressive historian in that school of thought. And he writes constantly about the Enlightenment's unacknowledged debt to medieval Christian thought. In fact, he uses this paraphrase of Shakespeare. I love this. There is more Christian philosophy in the images of the philosophes than has been dreamt of in our history. In other words, these leading lights of the Enlightenment in saying we're turning to pure reason were in fact turning, in some senses, to the reason that is built into man, given by God. Going back to what Seal said, it's the issue of do we recognize where this stuff came from? Because that's where the wheels come off, is when we think we've got it wired, that we invented it, that we figured it all out, and all of that. Let me Let me read you something. Social thinker Dennis Prager said, I love this. It has been a moral compliment of the highest order to Judaism and to the Jews that the Jews were the only people to canonize their critics. I love that. That captures the essence. The essence of the prophets is critique of the people. Against what? Against the standard of God's law and His righteousness. Which, by the way, in Deuteronomy 4, was given for their benefit and for the benefit of the nations. He said, the nations around you are going to see this social order that I have given you. Not that you came up with on your own. This social order, they're going to see this social order and say, wow, you have a great God. And you are a wise people to follow this great God. And the implication was that if Israel does the things of God, they are in fact going to prosper. In fact, listen to this from Deuteronomy 28. If you fully obey the Lord your God and keep all His commandments that I'm giving you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the world. You will experience all these blessings if you obey the Lord your God. Your towns and your fields will be blessed. Your children and your crops will be blessed. The offspring of your herds and flocks will be blessed. Your fruit baskets and bread baskets will be, breadboards will be blessed. Wherever you go and whatever you do, you will be blessed if you listen to these commands of the Lord your God, as I am giving you today. The Lord will make you the head and not the tail. You will always be on the top and never on the bottom. That's not a description of great people. That is a description of a great ethic. An ethic that produces. An ethic that does not manufacture poverty. The Judeo-Christian ethic, and if you recall if you read the online version of the bulletin, and if you haven't, grab it. There's a quote by the German philosopher Jürgen Habermas, who again is a declared atheist, who is essentially saying that you can't have Western civilization, you can't have this progress unless you've got the Judaic ethic of justice and the Christian ethic of love. And I believe those two are harmonized by Jesus Himself. Matthew 22. Yeah, John? Yeah. But it does work. Well, and the interesting thing there is that God predicts all of that in Deuteronomy. I mean, I just challenge you to go read the first 15 chapters of Deuteronomy. And it is like a looped tape. It is like a looped tape. I am giving you these great, gracious gifts of a social ethic that I guarantee you, if you do it, will produce great wealth, great prosperity. And not just wealth and prosperity in a purely physical sense. Wealth and prosperity in terms of satisfaction and happiness. Intact families. No envy. All these things that are really the bane of our existence. Relative lack and all of that are symptoms of larger diseases. And the fact is, what does he say every time? I'm giving you these great things, but take care that you don't forget who gave you these great things. That's the deal. Take care that you don't forget where this came from. And he predicts, you will forget where this came from. You're going to turn around and see these things as the product of your own intellect, the product of your own creativity. You're not even going to recognize that I gave you the intellect and I bred into you the creativity. That is an aspect of my nature. That's exactly. You're going to think that all this came from you. But here, but back to the main point, because we're about at the end here. There's so much more we could talk about. But in the simplest terms, I believe empirically, that is, based on the evidence, it is inarguable that something happened in the West that changed things for the better. The fact that we have standards of fairness that we have. The fact that certain things bother us. This book will get posted in the website, in the resources. One of the best books I have ever read. Udo Mittelmann is a German philosopher. He is the head of the Francis Schaeffer Institute. It is called Christianity Versus the Fatalistic Religion in the War Against Poverty. And he points out, again, that an ethic of self-critique, beginning with the prophets, and I use the term, as I've looked at Western history, I view it as the continuous running up against the inescapable implications of Judeo-Christian truth. Or as Habermas says, the Judaic ethic of justice and the Christian ethic of love. In other words, we as people, the West hasn't made more physical progress or social progress. And we have made not only physical progress, but we have made social progress. Hasn't made it because we are smarter, whiter, lived in better geographic realms, had a medieval warming period, et cetera, et cetera. And all of those are hypotheses that have been put forth about why it is that Western people achieved what they achieved. I am utterly convinced that, and we can't look at Western history, we will not look at Western history in this class without realizing that we're corrupt people. All people are corrupt. We have accepted ourselves from a certain level of the corruption. We were as tribal as any people on earth. You cannot read about European history. Nations didn't exist in Europe until the 1800s. Or rather, 1700s. Peace of Westphalia was where those nations came about. Germany wasn't Germany. Germany was a bunch of little petty dukies, as they were called. And they were all, for all intents and purposes, they were gangs. And they operated under the same zero-sum worldview that most every other gang operates under. Every other tribe operates under. I win, you lose. I win if you lose. The more I win, the better it is, because that's the more you lose. That is the way the world operates. The exception from that was this prophetic witness. Prophetic witness that, frankly, it could be ignored. It was resisted. But it was also like a, it was like a solvent. It was working. It was dissolving. The fact that it was there and it was always doing its thing is what I believe created what we call Western civilization, which I think is more properly called Christendom. We couldn't escape ultimately. We could try to, we could run away from it, we could hide our eyes. But the critique that is contained in the Judeo-Christian ethic, the self-critique, the habit of self-critique, then finds its way into other applications. The habit of self-critique is to say, I want to replace the is with the ought in my own character. I want to replace the is with the ought in my own culture. I also want to replace the is and the ought with the ought in terms of products, in terms of labor-saving devices, in terms of all sorts of things that were the germ of, we'll talk about this in a later class, of entrepreneurism, which is a French word that essentially implies an explorer. An entrepreneurism exploring ways to change the is to the ought. We do not see that. We don't see that drive. We do not see that drive. I mean, we don't see it. And Wenyo, that's something that we're taught. I mean, and Charles knows that. This fatalism that works its way into most cultures. And they are not just primitive cultures, by the way. The materialist viewpoint of Marxism is the ultimate fatalist religion. But you don't see this desire to examine what is, find it lacking, and change it for the better in other cultures. That is not to be triumphalist. The key, where the pegs get knocked out from under all of that is just like with the prediction about Israel. When we forget why that is, when we forget where that came from, when we forget the source of the blessing, we unhinge ourselves from it and we start seeing, in effect, good as bad. And in fact, good can be turned to bad because it's detached from its source. Does that make sense? I mean, Blaise's list is true. He can't credit it to Christianity. For Pete's sake, Ibn Warraq has to write under a pen name. He can't credit it to Christianity. But if we look at the Enlightenment, you got to account for the millions of people dead through the application of an Enlightenment reign of reason, beginning with the French Revolution. We're looking at pure head count. Christianity starts looking a whole lot better by that measure. That's not to be triumphalist. That is to say, let's not just appreciate what we've got and worry a little bit that we might have stolen it from everybody else. Let's look at what has happened and let's begin to turn both our own minds and the mind of our culture back toward the source. We talk about economics, we'll talk about that quite a bit from that particular viewpoint. A couple of things. I'm going to post an essay that's sort of based on this this class to the website, and it will have a number of different references attached to it. This book, I'm here to tell you, if you can afford the, you know, I think it's probably $8, $10. I scored one for Lance on Amazon for a penny plus $3.99 shipping. And it looks like it's never been opened. Wonderful book. The other article that I'm going to post is by Paul Johnson, the eminent historian. Among his works is A History of Christianity, and he pulls no punches and he doesn't whitewash it. But this article is called The Necessity for Christianity. It's outstanding, really, really good. And Lance has said that for next week for his class, feel free to go into the list of resources and read anything that you'd like to read that might relate to the history of Christianity. So thank you. Hope I didn't ramble too much.